Welcome to Health Matters, the Mental Health Edition. I'm your host, Dr. Shelley Visconti, licensed psychologist, counselor, and marriage and family therapist. This evening, we are discussing setting children up for success in the school year ahead. We invite our listeners to call in with comments and questions. Our number is 1-800-552-8502. This evening, we have as our guests Dr. Bart Wagner, child and adolescent psychiatrist, Dr. Sonia Poole, licensed professional counselor and early intervention services facilitator, and Ms. Warlita Williams, licensed clinical social worker and certified school social worker specialist. Thank y'all for being here this evening. We appreciate y'all being here and sharing your expertise and experiences. So, Dr. Wagner, I'd like to start with you. Just tell us a little bit about you and what you do.
Well, first, Shelley, thank you for inviting me to be on your program this evening. I received my medical training here in Shreveport at the LSU School of Medicine, and then did my general in child and adolescent psychiatry training at LSU Health Sciences Center in Shreveport as well. And I am in private practice here in Shreveport, where I mainly focus on children and adolescents. I do see some adults on a limited basis.
Dr. Poole, how about you? Tell us a little bit about yourself.
All right. Thank you again for having us, Shelley. I am a licensed professional counselor, a national certified counselor, and a nationally certified school psychologist. I currently work as an early intervention services facilitator in DeSoto Parish Schools and primarily do evaluation, counseling, crisis intervention, and some skills training there.
Ms. Wagner, what about you? Tell us about you.
Good evening, and thank you so much for having me today. My name is Warlita Williams. I am a licensed clinical social worker. I received my Master's of Social Work from Grambling State University. I am currently working for DeSoto Parish School Board as a school social worker. I, again, am a licensed clinical social worker as well as nationally certified with NASW as a certified school social work specialist.
And again, I invite our listeners to join our conversation. This evening, we will be talking about setting up children for success in the school year ahead. Please call in with your question or comment at 1-800-552-8502. So starting a new school year can be difficult for everybody in the family, not just the children. Just adjusting to the new school schedule and maybe going to a new school and teachers and friends can be difficult. Do y'all have any suggestions as to how to not only help the child adjust, but also help the family in general adjust?
I think one thing that parents and families can do is a lot of times schools have open houses and they have events for the family to come out, meet teachers, meet the staff. And so that's always a good avenue to go to attend. And also, if you've moved to a new area, getting involved with some of the community activities and clubs and group within the community where the school is located is always good for the entire family to do, because you get a chance, the parents get a chance to be parents of other students that will be attending the schools. So, and getting to know the staff as well when you go to open houses and things of that nature.
Right. And a lot of times getting back into that routine can be difficult for children, even if they're not going to a new school or a new area. So getting some structure in early, getting back to that normal routine of having times to go to bed, times to get up, having some activities during the day to keep them kind of occupied, and helping them get organized, getting their supplies ready, getting everything together early on so they are prepared as they can be when it's time to return.
Yeah, I would just second that. I see in my practice a lot of children that aren't on a good sleep schedule, and they've been allowed to maybe stay up a little bit later during the summer, and parents really need to start getting them back into that schedule a couple of weeks before school starts. And really the best way to do that is to not insist on a bedtime so much as insist on a time when they need to get up And if they start getting up earlier in the morning and not sleeping so late, they'll be tired in the evening and they'll start going to bed at an appropriate time.
Oh, yeah, that's a good suggestion. Then it's kind of naturally they're going to be tired in the evening, and hopefully it won't be quite as much of a struggle to get them in bed at a decent time. Yeah, and I was going to ask about how far in advance. So usually about a few weeks.
A few weeks would be perfect. That may not be necessarily feasible, but that would be my recommendation.
Mm-hmm. So any signs that a child is not adjusting well, or signs that a child is adjusting well, or that the family is not really adjusting?
Well, just noticing any changes in that child's behavior, things that are out of the normal realm for them. So if you have a child that's typically energetic and excited and communicative, they become kind of withdrawn, quiet, tend to isolate themselves, those can be some warning signs that maybe something's going on, that they're feeling uncomfortable. But the biggest thing is just talking to your children, listening what they're actually saying to you, and being active in that conversation with them, so you can tell if anything is going on or changing in their environment.
Watching grades to make sure grades are not dropping, assignments are still being done. And also sometimes we see behavior problems manifest in kids that we've not seen before when they are having difficult times adjusting.
Yeah, and we may see those behavior problems at school and at home.
Absolutely.
Yeah, sure. Anything else that we should be looking for?
Well, again, communication with the teachers. And sometimes parents are a little bit, not resistant, but hesitant to contact the teachers early in the school year, and if they have any concerns at all, it could just be on past performance, the previous grade. They really ought to reach out to the teacher and set the expectation that they'll be in the loop if there's any issues in the classroom.
Yeah, and I worked as a school counselor for a while, and the teachers seemed to appreciate. They didn't feel like they were being bugged or anything like that. They seemed to appreciate having a heads up if a child was having some difficulties, or maybe started a new medication, or just the parents just touching base and seeing how the child is doing. The teachers seemed to really like that for the most part, you know, having the parents involved.
Right. And from my experience working with teachers, if you're involved from the beginning, if they know that communication line is open, they're going to be much more apt to communicate with you early on if something occurs, if there's an issue with your child, or if they start to notice any changes in their behavior or their grades. So if they know that you are willing to have that discussion with them and keep those lines open, then they will come to you a little bit more quickly sometimes.
Sure. There's nothing more frustrating than it's springtime and the child hasn't been doing well all year, and then suddenly we get a call, or parents suddenly become concerned, and that's really frustrating, because something possibly could have been done much earlier and headed off the problem to begin with. So I think that's really important, is establishing that communication early and monitoring your child throughout the school year, so that you're not the teacher isn't all of a sudden, you know, approached by the parents wanting guidance and assistance. So we already talked a little bit about, you know, establishing that contact with teachers immediately. Should we wait a few days, or should we go ahead like before school even starts and send an email, or what? Any suggestions as to when that communication should start? I know we said early, but any suggestions?
I encourage some of my parents, once school has begun, to reach out to the teacher and find out if they communicate on things like Dojo, to send information. So if you're reaching out early, just at least finding out information of ways that you can communicate with the parent, I think is always good.
So if nothing else, just establishing how the teacher prefers to communicate.
Right.
Okay. Right. And Ms. Williams mentioned that most schools now have those back to school nights early on. So that's the perfect time to connect with those teachers and see how they want to have that communication, because some may prefer email, and then there's like apps that teachers download sometimes that I know they can send out messages to all the parents of students in their class. You want to make sure you're connected in those ways if they're available, like that Dojo program that she mentioned.
Yeah, and I've used that Dojo program, and it's pretty easy. I'm not the most tech-savvy person, and I was able to navigate it fairly easily. So I think that probably most parents would be able to navigate that, and it is really great because not only do you get information, but you also get cute pictures and things like that sometimes, you know, just being able to see what your child is up to. So if we notice that the child is having difficulty or seems to be falling behind, when should we become concerned? When should we take action? How should a parent handle this?
Talking to your child immediately, I think, and kind of get a feel from the child what he or she feels like is going on. And then once you've gotten that information from your child, then reaching out to the teacher, I would say, when you see things are starting to fall or to change, I would reach out to the teacher immediately to see what interventions or there are things that you can put in place at home. If there are after school programs at the school in the evening that you can enroll your child in, I suggest immediately when you find out there's a change.
So as soon as you see a grade start to drop. Then go ahead and just make contact and at least try to figure out what your options maybe are.
Right,
is that
right? Correct. And even if the child tells you that he's struggling, he or she is struggling in a class or having difficulties, again, talking to them and get a feel from them what they feel like is going on, and then reaching out to the teacher.
Mm-hmm. So again, it sounds like that communication is really, really important to maintain that communication, and not only with your child, but also with the teacher. I invite our listeners to join our conversation. We are discussing setting children up for success in the school year ahead. Please feel free to call in with your question or comment at 1-800-552-8502. So we've established, you know, talking to our children, talking to the teacher. Is there a point when we should talk with the school counselor, or we should talk with the principal? What are y'all suggestions?
A lot of times when you've gone through and met with the teachers and talked about things, if your student still continues to struggle or have concerns, they may invite you to attend a school building level committee meeting. And that's an environment where the teachers are there, the counselor may be there, the administrators may be there, and it gives you an opportunity to kind of talk to them about your concerns with your child. The teachers can voice kind of what's going on, and you can work together to develop a plan to help meet your child's needs and help them be more successful.
So at that point, then the school itself might start bringing in other staff members and so forth to meet with the parent and ensure that the child's needs are being met, or at least discuss what the child might be needing.
And that can be very informal, or in some cases it can be more formal, and that is when things like a individual education plan needs to be put in place. And if there are any accommodations that the child requires so that they can succeed. And some of these can be very, very, very easy to implement. It may just be a case of placing the child up in the front of the classroom, closer to the teacher's desk, or it may be more involved to the point where specialists in the school district will become involved for other types of could be occupational or speech therapy, for example, would be a good one. And, you know, the more involved it is, or the more services that are needed, it becomes a little more involved and requires some coordination with multiple people.
And I know that it can be kind of intimidating for parents sometimes. I know that even, you know, I work with children, I work with teachers and schools and so forth, and it can be a little confusing to me as to, okay, so now what's the next step? What do we do now? What is it? Because all the different letters, SBL, you know, and then the 504s and the IEPs, and, you know, what does all this language mean? So I usually encourage parents to ask questions, take notes. And then there are advocates that can assist. Is that correct?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If the parent feels like that they are not understanding fully or just need some extra support during those meetings and things like that.
And many of those advocacy agencies are available free of charge as well to parents. So that's a great service for them to utilize if they're feeling confused or overwhelmed by all of the information, because it can be very overwhelming when you have several adults in a room using school jargon that you're not necessarily mm-hmm. familiar with, but know that usually they're presenting as a team that wants to help mm-hmm. your child.
Yes.
It's just getting through all of that, like I said, that jargon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and whenever I've stopped people within the school system and said, okay, but what does that mean? You know, mm-hmm. You know, they've been very good about kind of holding my hand and explaining what all of that means. So I would assume that that would be the same experience for most parents, that people would be more than happy if the parent stops and reminds them that not everybody knows what these different things mean.
And understand that it's a process and there are steps to take. I think sometimes parents may get frustrated because they don't see things moving as fast, but when they come in to meet with the SBLC, then we make a determination if we're going to proceed with an evaluation, and with that comes interventions being done to see if a evaluation is really warranted, and then you have to have your data to prove, you know, you've done the interventions and they're working or they're not. And if they're not working and you're going to proceed to do an evaluation, then that takes 60 days to complete that evaluation. So there is a process, and so then after the 60 days is done, after the evaluation is done, then you go into doing the IEP. So it's a process that parents need to understand that they're working on it.
Sure,
but it
sure.
just takes time to get to the yeah. place where you need to be.
And there's a reason for that process. We want to try, we want to implement some things, we want to try them, and we want to give them time to see if they work.
Absolutely.
And we want to observe and see what's working and what's not working in a very organized manner so that we'll have more information to move forward. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes it can look like not much is being done, but really it's kind of an information gathering stage to see, you know, what's working, what's not working, how is it working, how is it not working, and then be able to make a better educated decision as to, you know, where we need to go next.
Right. Absolutely. And Dr. Wagner talked about different interventions you can use, because, you know, sometimes it may be that the child is not hearing. So he may need to move closer to the teacher. Sometimes it may be things with eyesight and they need glasses. So that's why we do the interventions, to actually get a gauge on exactly what is going wrong and what the kid needs.
Right. And with regards to, you know, students who may be having behavior concerns, you know, it may just be something as simple as implementing some sort of reward system for them to encourage them to engage in appropriate behaviors. Or sometimes we may need to teach those skills, because students may have behavior deficits in various areas where they didn't learn those skills the way other children did through modeling and things like that. So being able to have that time to see if we can remediate those areas and help them before we get to that evaluation stage. And the same with academic concerns, you know, providing that extra little support, that extra remediation, to see if we can get them to a place where they are, you know, on grade level before we get to the point where we actually step in and possibly provide those special education services.
Mm-hmm. So we talked a little bit about, you know, when to call the teacher. When should we maybe call a psychiatrist?
That's a great question. Well, first of all, I would preface this by saying that for ADHD, for example, which is a big issue in the schools and our children. Most children with ADHD, if they're being medically treated for that, are probably receiving those prescriptions from their primary care doctor, either a family medicine doctor or a pediatrician. Not that I don't see patients that have never been to a doctor regarding these issues, but typically a child and adolescent psychiatrist such as myself, we get the harder cases. So if a pediatrician, most pediatricians are comfortable with several medications. And if those are found to be ineffective or they're having some side effects, and then now their toolkit has kind of been used up, they may refer to a specialist, and then I get involved. You know, a lot of kids that have ADHD have other mental health concerns. Anxiety, about a third of children that are diagnosed with ADHD also have anxiety. There's a lot of kids that have depression as well. And straightforward ADHD can be completely managed by a primary care doctor. That's not a problem. But if there's other issues that are making that treatment not effective, then that's typically when someone like myself gets involved.
Yeah, and we do see that, you know, children with ADHD who develop self-esteem, you know, problems with their self-esteem because they haven't performed well in school, and then depression or maybe some test anxiety or things like that. And then also the ADHD, and then also maybe if perhaps a child, we thought it was ADHD, and then maybe we're wondering if it's a bipolar disorder. Is that something also that we might want to go to a psychiatrist rather than our family doctor?
Well, If there's a strong family history of significant mental illness such as depression or bipolar, that would be a concern. But again, if the first line medication that is being tried is effective and the child's doing better and they're not having side effects, then I probably will never get involved. It's when the medication isn't working or they're having significant issues taking the medicine, things like worsening anxiety, insomnia, weight loss, or at least no weight gain in a child is certainly of concern. So in cases like that, I will see patients. You know, bipolar is out there. It's relatively rare in children. Not that it can't occur, but generally speaking, there's other issues that are more likely to occur.
Sure. I want to invite our listeners to join our conversation this evening. We are discussing setting children up for success in the school year ahead. Please call in with your question or comment. The number is 1-800-552-8502. So sometimes when a child is having difficulties, we already kind of talked a little bit about accommodations and maybe an IEP. Would y'all mind going into that a little more in depth and explaining that process and when an IEP might be appropriate, when maybe it's not appropriate?
So like Ms. Williams was saying, typically if a family is referred by the teacher or if the parent has concerns and they're brought in for that school building level committee, that kind of initiates what we call the response to intervention process. So that's where we start those layers, those tiers of intervention that we're going to use to help that child. And typically we kind of go through the tier one interventions, which is what everyone gets. And those are kind of universal. And then tier two is maybe some small group or some different things. And then tier three is really that intense intervention where it may be more one-on-one. And once we've gone through that process with those tiers of intervention, if we're not seeing any improvement as far as through our progress monitoring with their behavior or with their academics, that would be the time that we would talk about possibly opening them for an evaluation through that IEP process. So the evaluation would consist of several components, and that would depend on kind of what the concerns are with the child. But the major things that are usually included are academic testing to see where they're at academically. If there's cognitive concerns, we may do some IQ testing, cognitive testing. If there's concerns about their ability to function, which is daily activities, we may do some adaptive scales. There's just several different pieces that are included in that when we're looking at an evaluation, but it's all determined by what the student's deficit areas are, what their needs are, and what we need to see if we can provide to them.
Mm-hmm. What about a waiting list? Is the testing done pretty quickly, or is this something that sometimes there's a long wait to get the testing done?
Well, once we open a student for an evaluation, we have 60 days to complete that evaluation. So the testing will take place at various points during that timeline. We have several staff that are involved in that process, so it kind of depends on what everyone has on their schedule at the time. So some people may be available to get to their piece of the testing right away, whereas others it may take them a little longer, but we do have to have that completed within that 60-day timeline.
So this isn't a situation where a parent or a child's going to have to wait 6 months or even until the next school year or something like that. It's a process that's going to take about 60 days, and you may do a little of the testing now and a little testing later and so forth.
Right. Okay. And a lot of times what takes so long that parents may sometimes get frustrated with is that response to intervention process, because we do have to work through those three tiers and we have to try several different things to see if those interventions can be effective. But once we get to the point where we've said, okay, we've tried these interventions, we're doing progress monitoring, we're checking their status to see how they're doing and things aren't improving, and we open them for that evaluation, then we have that 60-day timeline there to get that done.
So what about, I know that occasionally we'll have parents call and want a private evaluation. What's the difference? Does it matter? What do the schools prefer and usually recommend?
Well, in the school system, we can't actually use an outside evaluation to qualify a student for special education services. We can review that information and incorporate a summary of it or pieces of it into our evaluation process when we're writing that report up, but we can't actually rely on that outside evaluation. We have to conduct our own internal school-based evaluation. And the reason for that is in the clinic setting, typically diagnoses and things like that are done using the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the 5th edition, whereas in the school system, we're based on our state requirements through Louisiana Bulletin 1508, and those don't always align. We see that a lot specifically with autism, mm-hmm. because the clinical diagnosis of the autism and the school-based autism diagnosis are very different, and sometimes that creates some frustration for parents as well, because in the school system, we have to show that diagnosis of autism is impacting them in the educational setting. And sometimes we have students who are performing well academically who have that diagnosis. It's just impacting them maybe in their social skills or things like that, so it's not as much that academic functioning. So that's why we have to do an internal evaluation, because we don't go by the exact same guidelines, so mm-hmm. to speak.
Mm-hmm. So a parent could do that. However, the school is going to do their own evaluation. It's not that they won't look at what's been done, but still the school is going to do their own evaluation.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And private evaluations can be costly. So
that's true.
Yeah.
Yes.
And insurance typically doesn't pay for it. So that's another thing to keep in mind. I invite our listeners to join our conversation. This evening we are talking about getting children ready to have a successful school year. Please call in with your question or comment. Our number is 1-800-552-8502. So it sounds like the first thing, if we are concerned about our child maybe needing to have these meetings or an IEP or so forth, we talk with the teacher, and then the teacher will help to guide us through the process. Is that correct?
And all the time, it does not lead to evaluation. Mm-hmm. It could possibly be a 504 plan, which is a regular education intervention that they do, and it's called an IAP instead of an IEP, but it also has strategies and interventions that will be used in the classroom with the student.
Mm-hmm. So if these interventions are implemented, they are not successful, then the evaluation would be done. Can you explain to me when it's decided that an evaluation is done? How is that decided?
Was decided by the team. There's a team. We have, with our team, we have a school psychologist, educational diagnostician, a school social worker, and then you also have maybe speech therapists, PTs, OTs included. And so it's a team decision. We get together and look at the evaluation and defend our portions that we've done. And so the team decides if it falls within the guidelines of.
So you would review the data you have as far as what has been attempted, what has been successful, what maybe hasn't been successful, and then taking that information, that data, then as a team make a decision regarding whether, hey, this child seems to be doing pretty good with the plan we've got together, or this child needs some additional testing to try to come up with a different plan or just more information. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. And, you know, like I said, the parents sometimes get frustrated with that response to intervention process because of its length. But there are many times that we have students who come through the school building level committee who are struggling, and we put those tier two or tier three interventions in place and see dramatic improvements. So it never gets to that point of an evaluation because we put those interventions in place and they are making progress. They're doing well. So at that point, we wouldn't necessarily get to the evaluation. So it's a great thing that we have that process in place, even though it is sort of time consuming sometimes.
Mm-hmm. So Dr. Wagner, do patients come in with these concerns about services at school and accommodations and things like that?
Yes, they do. I see that frequently, and I'm certainly not the expert like the other panelists are here as far as getting services in the school, but I do encourage them to be on top of things and don't be shy. You know, one thing I always recommend that they do is ask for an evaluation in writing. I think the law actually mandates that the school has to do that if it's in writing. Not that this happens frequently, but sometimes I do have parents that have asked and maybe haven't been as forceful as they needed to be, and were kind of maybe put off or delayed, and the process was never really ever initiated. So I recommend that they just put it in writing. It doesn't need to be fancy, and I offer a letter of support. Now, you know, from a legal standpoint, my letter means nothing because I'm not the guardian. The guardian has to write the letter, but it may add a little bit of weight to what we're trying to get done. A letter from me. Mm-hmm.
And I think you brought up a really good point about encouraging parents to be vocal and ask questions. You know, if they have concerns, make sure you're voicing those to the teachers or to the administrators or the counselor at your school, because there are many, many children in the school system, and we want to make sure that we're doing everything we can to help your child and help them be successful. So if you have concerns or questions, you know, be vocal about those things and speak up. Don't be afraid.
So. Yeah.
And we use a lot of acronyms. We try when we're in SBLC not to use them.
Yeah.
But it's always good if you don't know what an acronym is, ask.
Sure.
To
yeah.
find out additional yeah. information, because sometimes parents do leave those meetings and they don't have a clue about what they've heard, and they are embarrassed to ask.
Yeah,
so
there's
no
reason to be embarrassed. No. I know, and I get caught up sometimes, you know, it's PTSD or it's an SSRI or it's GAD or what, and we forget because we're used to speaking in that kind of lingo that other people don't always know. So yeah, absolutely, speak up and say, I don't know what that is. Could you explain that? And nobody's going to think any less of you if you do.
Right.
Again, I want to invite our listeners to join our conversation. Call in with your question or comment on getting school children ready for the school year ahead. The number is 1-800-552-8502. So when a new school year starts, does the whole process start again, or do things kind of pick up where they left off? How, if a child is receiving services, what happens the next school year?
So if a child has already been identified as receiving those special education services, they'll have an individualized education program in place, and that will continue with them. So if they move to a different teacher, move to a different school setting, all of that will transfer with them. And at the onset of each year, typically the teacher who holds that IEP, the one who's responsible for it, in charge of it, will contact the parents and, kind of go over the accommodations again, review the information, see if there's anything that's changed that needs to be updated. So it's a document that is alive. It grows. It changes with the student. It travels with the student. So it's there with them. Now, if we have a student sometimes who's in the evaluation process at the end of the school year, typically we don't work on those during the summer. We will take what we call a summer extension. So we will just kind of hold whatever information we have available at that time. And then when school starts back up again, we'll kind of pick up with that evaluation where we left off.
So I know that we have talked about children who are maybe having some difficulties, but children who are gifted can also have some special needs. Would y'all mind talking a little bit about the gifted process and how a child is determined to be gifted and any services that might be available to a child that's gifted?
So if we have a child that's gifted, they can be referred, again, through that SBLC process, that school building level committee, by either their teacher or by the parent. The teacher has to do sort of a screening form that looks for several different areas, like, academic aptitude, creativity, intelligence, certain things that they might observe with that child in the classroom setting. And then if the student passes that screening process, then we would conduct an evaluation. And in our district, we have an educational diagnostician who will go in and do the academic testing to see where the child falls as far as their academic abilities. And then we have a school psychologist who will go in and do cognitive testing to see where they are as far as their ability to process information and their memory and aspects related to intelligence. And then once those pieces have been completed, they will receive a report that'll the person who is coordinating that case will go through with them. And then they too will receive an individualized education program that will qualify them for those gifted services. And in the district where we're located, those students are pulled out multiple times per week, and they meet with the gifted teacher and several other students and work on kind of some advanced activities and things in that setting.
And there's also the talented program too as well, so kids that are gifted in the arts, so it could be in kids that sing, that play the piano, art, drama. I think that's about all. We also do evaluations for those kids too.
Okay.
And then we have instructors to come in and work with them in those different areas that they've qualified mm-hmm. for. So it follows the same process that Dr. Poole talked about for the gifted children. Mm-hmm.
I want to invite our listeners to join our conversation. This evening, we are talking about setting children up for success in the new school year. The number to call in with your question or comment is 1-800-552-8502. So if we have a child that did not have that great of a school year, maybe there was some bullying, or maybe they were just struggling academically, how do we get them on board for the new school year and having a great new school year? Do y'all have any suggestions?
I think meeting with the teachers or administrators up front at the beginning of school, right when things are getting started, and even having that student participate in that meeting, letting that student express what their frustrations are, what their fears are, what their concerns are, and then letting them know that people are there to help them, that these adults are all in the room to listen and help find a solution for the concerns or problem, and that everyone is going to do what they can to help them have a happy and successful school year. So a lot of times for children, having that opportunity to be heard and know that their opinions, their feelings are valued can be important, and then developing a plan to address whatever that need may be.
Hmm. So letting the child know that that adults are listening to what they have to say and what they're thinking, and that they have the support system that's there to try to help them. Is that? Yeah.
Correct.
So do you, in your practice, Dr. Wagner, do you see a lot of issues with children as far as bullying and things like that?
I have experienced that. It is an issue that is of concern, and you know, the bullying that is occurring in this day and age is so much different than when I was growing up with the technology. Children and adolescents are really connected through the technology 24 hours a day if they have access at night to their iPad or their smartphone. You know, when I was young, we got a break from the bully after school was over. When we went home, hopefully we had some supportive friends in the neighborhood, and then when the weekend came, we were kind of away from the school setting. But with the kids being so connected now, it can just fester and actually blossom after school. Mm-hmm. So particularly with the bullying that goes online, children that are playing video games online, and then if they're involved in group texting with friends, or as my daughter used to tell me, you know, frenemies. So it is very prevalent, and it can cause a lot of emotional problems for these children. And I see that in my office. And once again, it's all about communication with the school. Parents sometimes, and children even more so than their parents, are resistant to report it because they're afraid of repercussions. Mm-hmm. And you know, if one child or one parent complains about a bully, the school may not have enough to intervene if they haven't seen it. But if more than one family comes forward, now we have a pattern. And I think the schools are, you know, the administrators are going to be a lot more willing to intervene in those situations. So I encourage families to let the schools know if this is going on.
Mm-hmm. And Dr. Wagner, I think you brought up a really good point about the cyberbullying, because that's a new phenomenon that we as an older generation aren't used to. It's something new, and we don't necessarily know how to address it or how to handle it. But I think for parents, the biggest thing they can do is supervise their children. You know, if you're letting your child go online, or if they have a cell phone and they can communicate with others, or like you said, playing those video games online with other students, just know who they're talking to, know what they're talking about, know what's going on, because supervision is going to be the biggest piece to making sure that cyberbullying is not occurring outside of school.
And parents, I feel they need to encourage their children to speak up and speak out against it, and just let them know how bullying is something that can be with a person for the rest of their lives. I tell the story all the time. I was bullied as a child, and my story is that I ended up working with the person that bullied me, and just terrified to have to deal with that person because of something that happened when I was 15 or 16 years old. So it's something that remains with you. And I think kids just need to really speak up and speak out about it. There are different things that go on in communities and at schools with anti-bullying and prevention programs, and be a part of that and spread the message that there's, you know, that we don't want bullying in our schools.
And I think that the supervision that you mentioned is so important, because it's not only bullying that can happen online, but there are so many other dangers that kids can be exposed to. Predators, just inappropriate materials, just lots of not good stuff.
Yes, I tell parents all the time that I think children nowadays mature much faster because they're exposed to so many things at an early age, whereas, you know, things we didn't know about until we were much older.
Sure.
If they're not being supervised online, they have free access to anything that is out there, and that's a scary concept.
Yeah. I want to invite our listeners to join our conversation this evening on getting children ready for the new school year ahead. The number is 1-800-552-8502. Please call in with your question or comment. So a lot of times homework is a big issue that parents come in and talk with me about. Any suggestions to make homework less painful?
I think the first step is setting up a good homework routine. You have an environment where you can sit down with your child and you can work on that together free of distractions. Having a certain time that you do that, whether it's better if you do that right when you come in the door in the evening and get that out of the way or whatever, but having some structure, even though it's after school, you're at home, having some structure to that homework routine and that plan, I think helps kind of solidify the importance of that for students.
Utilizing tutoring programs in the schools and the community, I hear parents tell me a lot of times that some of the work that their children have, they can't do it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, finding out about different websites that will assist. There's just so much out on the web to assist students today, but finding that information out from the teachers about things that you can use to help your kids with their homework.
What about children with special needs? Is there a particular way that we should approach homework if a child, let's say, has a learning difficulty or ADHD or something like that?
Well, I treat a lot of children that have that diagnosis of ADHD, and if they're on medication, some medications are only going to be effective until around the dinner hour. If they're effective much past the dinner hour, they aren't going to be able to sleep very well. So that's kind of a case of diminishing returns. So for those children, really getting the homework done after school, kind of in the before dinner, would be ideal. That always isn't going to happen. There are other medications that we don't have to worry about that, and they can maintain their focus into the evening. So that does kind of drive my choice of medication for those people.
So knowing your child's medications and how it impacts your child, and trying to kind of plan part of your schedule around that, sounds
yes,
like.
Yes, exactly.
Any other suggestions for children with learning difficulties or any other kind of special needs?
If they've had an evaluation done, there will also be some interventions listed on that IEP that can be put in place at home as well. We give a list of interventions or strategies that can, and parents most definitely need to use those, put those in place at home.
So the school will actually provide some suggestions for things to do at home. Okay, great. I invite our listeners to call in and join our conversation. The number is 1-800-552-8502. So I have a nephew who just goes in, does his homework, and tells you when he's done, and like, come check my homework, and it's just fabulous, but not everybody, not all children are like that. How do we develop those study skills, kind of that internal motivation early on? Any suggestions as to how to kind of get kids into the habit of doing homework and being conscientious about their schoolwork early on?
Well, I think a lot of it I would say that parents need to try to be as positive as they can. You know, homework can be seen as a chore, but it's really, if they keep up with their work at home, their grades will be maintained. You know, there's a lot of, I see this a lot, there's a lot of points left on the table by these children that don't do their homework. Mm-hmm. They get zeros, and that just destroys their average for that class. And I get a lot of feedback from parents that get frustrated. Well, you know, he just won't turn in his homework, or he won't do it, and he has all these zeros. You know, I use medication, but I'm also kind of a behavioral guy, and I really believe that children, and all of us actually, we respond to consequences, good consequences and bad consequences. Now, we sometimes only focus on the punishment. Oh, well, if you don't bring your grades up, I'm going to take away your Xbox or your phone or whatever. And that's fine, but actually rewards are much more reinforcing for those good behaviors. So I encourage families to really, really acknowledge when their child has a good day. Really, really acknowledge that, because that will reinforce the good habits that they're having, and not just focus on the days that are kind of a struggle.
And I think a lot of parents don't realize just how reinforcing their encouragement is. They're, you know, saying, what a fantastic job you did. Wow, look at this. And really giving that positive reinforcement that kids, I mean, most kids will eat that up. And, you know, sometimes you have to take it a step further and give some kind of other type of reward. But really, a lot of time, giving that child some attention and just a verbal praise, a reinforcer, will go a long way. I want to invite our listeners to join our conversation. Call in with your question or comment at 1-800-552-8502. So, and I'm sure this has happened to most parents, you find out at the last minute that there's a big project due or there's a big test the next day, and it's so frustrating. How can we avoid this?
Constant communication with the teacher. Right. Using Docho, using Remind Me apps.
Right. I know we've mentioned communication a lot this evening, but that really is the biggest piece. You know what's going on with your child, know what's going on in that classroom, be able to talk to that teacher regularly and see what's going on. Some teachers will send home, like agendas of what the homework is or what's going on. Sometimes they post those online, or they may send those through Docho or different apps. So just being aware and having that communication open is the biggest piece.
I know for some of the kids that have ADHD that are on my caseloads, we do notebooks for them. And so they have to write assignments down. Teacher signs those the notebook, and then the parent has to sign it once the child comes mm-hmm. home. Mm-hmm. So that keeps you in the loop of knowing what's due and what's coming up.
And I have found that even the way that the parent asks, sometimes parents will ask, do you have any homework? And the child will say, no, I don't have any homework, but they have a test in a couple of days that they could right. be studying for. Right. So, you know, kind of how you ask your child, do you have any homework? Do you have any tests coming up? Do you have any projects coming up? What's going on, you know, in the next week and things like that? But also, keeping in touch with the teacher seems to be really helpful.
Right. And with some of the children that I've worked with, you know, depending on their age, you may just need to check their backpack. Check their binder, see what's in there, because it's much more appealing for a child to come home and say, no, I don't have homework yeah. and go play video games than it is to sit down and do that work sometimes.
Sure.
So just check it through their materials and seeing if there's anything there as well.
We have a caller. We have Tammy from Shreveport. Tammy, go right ahead with your question or comment.
Hi, yes, thank you. I was calling. I have a 2-year-old twin girls, and I just wanted to see, what do you all recommend? Like, I work from home, and they're at home with me. But what do you recommend in terms of, like, them being at home with me, like, time frame of being able to sit, because their attention span is so short? What's a good time frame for two-year-olds to sit down and be able to listen, pay attention to, you know, basic things that we do, like flashcards, numbers, things like that?
I think, you know, two is pretty young. So I have a younger brother who has, and I have a nephew, and he's 10 now, but when he was about 3 to 4, he was very hyperactive and couldn't sit still. And they would always ask me, "Gee, does he have ADHD?" And he didn't. It was developmentally appropriate for his age to behave the way he did. And at age 2, I don't know if there's an exact time that I could quote you as far as how long they're going to be able to attend. Any amount would be great at this point.
Right. And I think you're right about that, Dr. Wagner. But, you know, if you can find things that are more engaging to them, that are, you know, active, that are fun, that are colorful, you know, that catch their attention, you might have a little bit more luck. They're still not going to be there for long. But things like that, or even small reinforcers like that praise, or some little tangible item might help with that. But again, they're not going to be still for long.
We have just a couple minutes left. Any final comments or suggestions for parents as far as, you know, keeping kids on a good path as far as the school year that has just started?
Well, I think we've said a lot to communication. Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, be aware of what's going on with your child. Know what they're doing when they're at home, when they're online. Be aware of what's going on in the classroom. Have that communication with the teacher. And just set that standard that's going to be the expectation for the year, so they know that what's expected of them.
Mm-hmm. And I would just say, you know, problems may arise, and they may not arise in August. They may arise in January. So children can start to have struggle at any time of the academic year, and so we just have to be vigilant. And if parents start getting feedback from the teachers, from their child's teacher, that they're starting to have problems, that can happen at any time, and it warrants an intervention sooner rather than later. So it may even be at the end of the school year, but if that is identified even then, that really sets that child up better for the coming grade in August.
Sure. So just the parent maintaining that contact with their child, with the teacher, remaining vigilant, and just remembering that early intervention is so helpful if we can catch these things early and start implementing some services or just some small changes, that can make a huge difference.
Right.
Thank y'all so much for being on the program this evening. We really appreciate everyone's expertise and all the information that you all have shared with us. We have Dr. Bart Wagner, child and adolescent psychiatrist, Dr. Sonia Poole, licensed professional counselor and early intervention services facilitator, and Ms. Warlita Williams, licensed clinical social worker and certified school social worker specialist. Thank you all again for being on this evening. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mental Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all mental health questions, consult a mental health professional. The views and opinions expressed on Mental Health Matters do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Red River Radio, LSUS, or its employees. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Mental Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Production assistance has been provided this evening by Wally Derleth, Al Villarreal, Tim Snell, and Sheila Lawrence. Support for this program comes from the Knoll Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and a gift from Kit and Lisa Gamble. I'm Dr. Shelley Visconti. Thank you for joining us this evening. Have a great week.